640 Toronto presents Think Tank. The breaking stories you care about. Facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
All right, let's do that. Love when we have this pair on. It always starts our week, and we always have a lot to review from the weekend. So no better people than to do it with. And she's noted on her X account as city builder, housing leader. She is that, as well as a former deputy mayor of the city of Toronto. Anna Bailao joins us on Toronto Today. Great to have you back.
Good morning.
And as well, columnist. He's brushing off the pen and paper and maybe a little liquid paper as well. I don't think anybody uses that anymore. But Anthony Fury joins us as well, a mayoral candidate from last spring also. Anthony, great to have you in.
I thought you were going to say brushing off the nine iron after the Scottie Scheffler win, my friend.
Listen, it wasn't nice enough to play golf until yesterday around 3 p.m. or so. We had a lousy weather weekend. I'm sure you're anticipating better days ahead, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And you're right. Lots happen on the weekend, whether it's sports or foreign affairs.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get there, that's for sure. When we left on Friday, it had obviously been a bit of a tumultuous weekend involving Toronto police and interactions with the public. In fact, Eclipse Day was a week ago today, and there was an officer attacked on Monday evening when he was trying to break up a car theft, and two people attacked him. One was arrested, one got away. But then Friday we have, and there ended up being rather gruesome footage posted of a stabbing involving a Toronto police officer. He was stabbed in the leg, but bottom line, and that alleged assailant was shot. But bottom line, Anna, we've had three Toronto police officers attacked in a 6-day span from that Monday evening until now. It's obviously concerning. No easy answers, no easy solutions. But I think we're all a little on edge because of this.
Absolutely. And, we've seen this violence against police increasing. And in our city, I would say even in North American cities, it's not only in the city of Toronto, but we've seen an increase in anti-police rhetoric as well that has been happening over the last few years. You know, it's a really hard job. I think any job, you don't expect to get out of your house in the morning and to get hurt, but especially when your job is, you know, to keep the peace, to keep, you know, a good state of safety in the city. It is very important that we give our police force all the tools, all the support that they need. And so, you know, when we had the budget, I was somebody that we talked about it here on how they needed the support. But we also have to acknowledge that, for example, in our city, we have a mental health crisis. And so, for example, it's not only the physical tools that they need and the support that we need to give them out there is to ensure that they have the training that they need to respond to situations that today are very different from a few years ago. So it is important that they have the tools and the support that they need, the training that they need to respond to the increase in violence, but also to the change of nature of violence that we see in our city today.
Anthony, I think Anna has it, and I also think you sign up to be a cop, and you're probably told expect the unexpected. We've all seen movies, TV shows, the wife or the husband kisses their partner goodbye and just hopes they come back unscathed at the end of the night. But this has been a rather harrowing 7 days, and I'd even make the case since October 7th. We've been asking police in the city to do more at times with less and address issues of foreign policy and foreign conflicts they probably never imagined they'd be addressing on our streets.
No, you're right. We've all seen the dramatic television shows, but the statistic, I believe, still holds true that most officers are able to go through their careers and retire without having discharged a firearm while in the line of duty. So thankfully, these sort of incidents don't typically occur for officers. Right now, Greg, it feels increasingly like the bad guys are calling the shots. And everyone feels it. And that is the trend that we need to reverse to bring back public confidence in our safety, to bring back the sense that officers feel they are supported. I think officers are supported by the public right now, but they are currently not supported sufficiently with resources, as Anna alluded to, with the budget. And they are not being supported by City Hall and by politicians as much as they could be. A lot of people were very upset by that letter that six of those city councillors signed last week. Two of them were police services board members. And these sorts of things do matter, because when the bad guys feel like, wow, I can get away with a whole lot more, they're going to do it. And that's what we're experiencing right now. I don't think these attacks on our police officers have happened in a vacuum.
I bet, to clarify, 27% of American police officers have at one point used their service revolver, which means 73% have not. I bet you it's lower in Canada, but to your point, that's close to one in four. And I'll make this point and stay with you on this, Anthony, and then get to Anna. The Toronto Police Association put out a statement Friday after that stabbing near Parliament that the individual, this is from the TPA, the individual that punched our officer this week was released on bail the next day, and that was a random attack. They write things have to change here. And though anybody would point out there's not much a municipal government or mayor can do to set bail, but you can say something about it. And it'd be great for city council to unite and say this exactly in a vacuum here isn't right. And I'm not sure we're getting that response from the city right now.
Well, let's not forget that open letter signed by those six councillors. That happened just a few days after the Palestinian Youth Movement gave a press conference calling to defund the police. And their letter was seen as a bit of a wink-wink in approval of that press conference. So you're absolutely right. I mean, if I was at council right now, I'd be pushing for everybody to go in front of the cameras on a united front and say, this is unacceptable. Three officers who have been attacked recently. We will not permit this, and we stand behind our officers. And if any one council member wants to say they're also an advocate for, say, police accountability, totally fine. I mean, that's not what we're opposed to here. We're opposed to the idea that you're sending a signal out there that City Hall does not even support the rank and file, which is what that letter did. And that is the climate that we are in right now, and that's very unfortunate.
And I mean,
let's be honest, but to go back to the bail thing just for one second here, Greg, if someone is going to assault a police officer, I mean, what else are they going to do? What other signal do you need to know that this person is a massive risk to public safety?
I have no idea who would defend somebody being out on bail for assaulting a police officer. I don't know what the logical argument is, the political argument, the ideological argument. I don't have a clue. And I'll step up and defend municipal politicians here and say it often feels like crime happens in our city or any city, as you document. And often the TV cameras and the microphones rush to the municipal politicians and they rush to the councillors and they rush to the mayor. And we don't do it as often with the premier and MPPs and MPs. And maybe we should. We all live together and we all vote.
And there's exactly like you said, the bail system is under the provincial jurisdiction. It was an issue, for example, during the mayoralty campaign. Many candidates, many of us called for bail reform. And as letters are being sent out on all kinds of issues related to the police, you're absolutely right. It would be, I think, a good step forward to have council united and come forward with a position on a request to the province on that bail reform, particularly when we're seeing this daily increase with police violence.
I'll stay with you, Anna, on this one. This is a really tough one. I saw this TV story yesterday with a protest outside. About 200 seniors from a building called Heritage Glen in Mississauga, and it's owned by Chartwell, are getting evicted. Now, this building is not doing well. It's only at about 60% capacity. And so they are a private business. They can ask people to move, but I think the political aspect of this is, can we find a way to prolong this so that we give them time and space? I get it. There's a lot of people in this building. I saw from the TV story, Anna, that were widowers. A lot of people are in their 80s. It's not the easiest thing to pick up the building that you know and love and find somewhere else. Around 200 residents got eviction notices asking them to leave by July 31st, which, again, might be ample time for a student, might be ample time for a married couple. But this is obviously causing some controversy here because it looks like it's cold and insensitive. What are your thoughts on the story? And could we find a happy medium and either extend this out and give them a lot more time? How do you see this?
We don't have all the details in front of us, but Greg, this is a symptom of what we're seeing across the rental market, across long-term care homes, and it's the lack of options and the lack of supply that people have. Can they move close by? Can they move to properties around the same pricing point? And right now, that's the challenge. If people can, when they have to move, either for their job or because the apartment is getting sold or renovated or so on, it becomes impossible to find something else within that price point. Or sometimes, if you're moving jobs, for example, we have people that cannot afford to move housing because then their costs would increase. So the lack of supply that we have in here is so big in the region and in the province, that focus, that laser focus that needs to happen in order to create more affordable housing, more purpose-built rental, and in this case, seniors' homes, especially when we're having an aging population. And we know what happened with long-term carers, with seniors' housing in the pandemic as well. These are huge needs that we have that are not going to get any better if we don't have the three orders of government with a very laser-focused approach on the issue.
It's a really tough story, Anthony. There's a woman quoted whose 92-year-old mother's being evicted by Chartwell, and she got a note back on April 3rd. But again, we're living in a different time right now. 120 days might have been sufficient 10, 15 years ago. That's asking a lot. And it's no fun for anybody. There's a woman probably in her 60s who's got to move a 92-year-old mother, and they need to find a place that's affordable within the next 4 months. Again, as Anna said, in the GTA right now, good luck. So all of this stinks.
Yeah, and it's not really something we typically think of, evictions of seniors' homes. This is something that I think is new to the way people think through these issues. The idea of lengthening the period makes a lot of sense, but the challenge is there's going to be some individuals there who just don't have a support network at all in terms of their family, probably people dealing with various dementia issues or similar issues where they have less supports than others, and that's going to be a total mess. So I do think that that's a place where some sort of counselor support could really get in there and help people out. Although I don't think any idea that an organization like this, a company like this, should never be able to renovate a building should be on the books. So I think finding the middle ground or helping these people out a little bit more is clearly what needs to happen.
I'll play a clip earlier, and we'll start with you, Anna, on this front. We had a rental agent called the show, and she was on for a little bit. Her name was Irina, and we talked to her. She painted a picture of how hard it is for people to get into the rental market. I wanted the audience to hear this clip, and certainly for you two to be able to react to it. Four roommates looking at a one bedroom and a den to split. Here's what she told us earlier in the morning.
On another occasion, I had four roommates come in to look at a one bedroom plus den. It's actually listed as a two bedroom, but it's not. It's a one bedroom plus den, which maybe could fit a twin bed, but I don't see how. And it's actually really sad that we have all these vacant units, but the price of these units is so high. And we talk about affordability, but it's not affordability. People that go to work and work every day cannot afford to pay rent. They're forced to split with another family and live in a basement.
And Anna, she said these four men were all in their 30s. Like, again, it's one thing. You're moving out, second, third year of college. You're going to rough it a little bit. Things won't be great, but they'll get better as you move along. This is a real stark reality of trying to rent in the GTA right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly what I was saying. And you know, the fact that there are some vacancies, the numbers and the studies that are coming out is well below a healthy vacancy rate. I mean, I think the latest number that we saw in Toronto is below 1.5%, which is not a healthy vacancy rate. We know that these impact prices as well. We haven't built purpose-built rentals since the 60s and the 70s to the rate that we need to. We have half of the population renting in the city of Toronto, but only about 15%. And that's a good year as of late, is actually purpose-built rental. And on top of it, you have significant costs. You know, you have 30% of the costs of a home, rental or condo, that are government fees. You have 50% of that cost that is labor and materials and so on. And all of these have been going up. Interest rates have been going up. So the cost of producing the home is much more expensive, and the vacancy is not that. So we hear those stories. When I was a counselor, you know, these are the real, real tough issues that I had to deal with we have families walking into the door with these very real stories is heartbreaking. And this is, as like I said, it's an issue that right now needs laser focus attention. Also, because especially around the last few months, because of the interest rates, nothing is getting built. Shovels are not getting on the ground. Like, there's no new construction really starting, and the situation is not going to get any better if we don't have more of the supply coming on board, and in particularly affordable housing, the ones that we can reduce the cost of producing and become more affordable for people to live in our city.
Anna, before I get to Anthony, are you seeing neighborhoods or areas of the GTA where there are good news stories where we're building units that could be the answer for people like that, or could be the answer for Irina mentioned a young family. They make about 110 grand combined, no kids, but they're still priced out right now. Are you seeing spots where we're starting to improve things, maybe say compared to a year ago?
There's affordable housing being built. It's just not to the numbers that we need them to. You know, there's projects in Toronto. You go to the West Don lands, for example, used to be provincial owned land that was designated to produce affordable housing units in there and market units. It's a mixed community, which is the best model that you need to use is when you have, market, affordable, supportive, all in there. So there's pockets. We just need to scale it up. We need to have it to respond to the scale of the issue that we have, and that has been the issue. And unfortunately, with all the costs increasing, it's becoming even more challenging. Yes, we're seeing actions. I know that we're going to be talking about the budget. There's lots of actions in there, but we need these to be implemented quickly. It should have been implemented years ago, and we need it. We need to hit the ground running and speed that running.
Yeah, we're going to get to that budget. And Anthony, I'll let you wrap on this. You and I talk a lot, and you about raising our kids. And I've got a kid headed to university next year. The residence costs are what they are. But you got kids younger than me, three of them, and you've got time on the clock. But this still must worry you to wonder where it's at 5, 6, 7 years from now when some of them start moving out. Unless you want to move them out sooner. I think it's fine for a 15-year-old to make his way in this city. I really do. So consider all the options there.
The oldest is 10, so I think there's laws against that. No, we do wonder, three boys, and even though they're little right now, so, one is 10, and that's whatever it is, 8, 9 years from now when he's going to move out to go to college or university, and is he going to move out? Are we going to have them at home? Because are they going to be able to afford it? What are the options going to look like? And even though it's a decade away, because to Anna's point, this is so caked into the system and these builds, sure, things happening, but not many units. These problems are going to persist for many years. So I do feel like these issues felt today are still going to be felt to a similar degree or some similar degree 8 years from now, which is very concerning.
It's a little bit interrelated to what we're talking about, but Anna referenced it. I jotted this down yesterday morning in advance of tomorrow's federal budget. The federal spending commitments just in the last 6 months from the Liberal government are $21 billion. We have a current $25 billion deficit. There's lost revenue, obviously, with tourism and other things post-COVID. So I've seen we hadn't really talked about it until coming into this weekend, Anthony, but this is starting to sort of resonate with people and the drumbeats are getting a bit louder that if people are going to pay more taxes. Taxes are going to go up tomorrow, aren't they? Many economists don't see how they can't with all this spending.
We're in an interesting political anomaly right now where it's very odd that so far away from an election, because we're about a year and a half away from the next October election, the governing party is very unpopular. The electorate clearly says they want them gone. The opposition is very popular. But there's a year and a half of the situation being like that, where the government more or less doesn't have a mandate to do what it's doing. Greg, normally this level of unpopularity would happen just before an election.
That's where Kathleen wins. She had to come out with a couple Ontario budgets, and people saw the writing on the wall, saw the train coming down the track, and they had to respond and find good and bad things about it.
Yeah, but my whole point is that this would normally be an election budget, so we wouldn't have to take these announcements seriously because we know that Trudeau would be out before he gets to implement it. But he's going to have another year. Like, we're frustrated about the carbon tax increase that just happened. Will it not happen? And it did. Next year's carbon tax increase is also going to happen. So we do need to take all these many billions of dollars of spending seriously. I think the Trudeau government will commence them, and they will have to commence the tax increases on the books. And it'll sort of be caked in. And then Pierre Poilievre, who looks like he's going to be next prime minister, is going to have to deal with these programs that are already set in place and likely reverse them. But it's a real mess that I think Trudeau's setting us up for, not reading the tea leaves and not sort of pivoting the way the electorate wants to.
You're talking programs like the meals for school kids and dental care, pharma care, that kind of thing.
Yeah, things that he's announced that are clearly electoral plays that I think the electorate isn't actually buying.
And it's tricky. That's
right. A lot of the announcements have been around housing, and I think people really wanted them to pivot to have real strong and bold investments in this area. I think that the opposition has been extremely successful in identifying an issue that struck a chord with the public, at which was housing. And I think the government identified that right away and has been putting, you know, almost on a daily basis in the last couple of weeks, announcements around housing. And a lot of this budget is going to be investments on housing. And I think the public really wanted those investments. So, I think people want to see these go through and have them implemented as soon as possible to have the impact that it needs to have.
And Anna, I hear people.
I think the public thinks the housing money is going towards building units. And I think it's good it's not, because the market doesn't work that way. But I think the public will be a little confused when they learn what the money's actually going to, which is really just to sort of support, you know, planning departments expediting things. So I think there's a disconnect between what the housing money is actually going towards.
And
There's $15 billion in, for example, construction loans that will facilitate the construction of housing. There's, money for nonprofits in order to have grant money to produce the units. So there's a mixture of things. Mm. Some of it is to provide zoning reform and planning changes so that the approvals can happen quicker. And then there's some, direct investment into ensuring that the math actually works and that both nonprofits and the private sector can get shovels on the ground. So there's a mixture of things in there. It's a comprehensive plan. It's a full new housing plan. They had one in 2017, and this is basically a redo of that housing plan.
And it's real dangerous, isn't it? Because I get the cry from afar: tax the wealthy, tax the corporations. I'm not opposed to it, but you have that balancing act, don't you? Because what if the wealthy leave? What if the companies leave? And then who do you have left to derive your funding from?
Yeah, and they produce the jobs. So it is a balancing act, and especially when, you know, many of the initiatives that the budget is going through is to create affordability. I'm sure that word you're probably going to have in every page of the budget when it gets launched tomorrow. So it is a really balancing act. It's not going to be easy. But it wouldn't surprise me that there's some new taxes in there. But the minister has been clear that she's not going to be taxing the middle class. So she's hinting at that. So we'll see what's going to come through in terms of new taxes. But I think that many people are expecting that there'll be some. But I think they're really going to strike that balance between a budget that is supposed to create affordability and new taxes.
All right, we wait in anticipation. Anthony, Anna, thanks so much for the time this morning.
Thank you.
Anna Bailao, Anthony Fury on Think Tank.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.